How good do we
sound?
Kate,
you're salty today.
I'm always salty.
All right.
I'm like a sailor.
You haven't been in the hot take-a-sphere.
The taking environment of the hot. I didn't really know where that sentence was going.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot smaller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, the full panoply.
Together
of Hot
again.
Takedown panelists.
What were we? The full what?
Full panoply.
I don't know that word.
It's like a cornucopia.
Okay.
A panoply, a selection of hot take.
You like to use just random words.
It's all to trip you up, Kate. That's Kate Fagan.
This is the new erstwhile Chad.
Listeners, please let me know if I'm misusing panoply, which is a podcast network, we should note. Kate Fagan.
Hi, Chad.
ESPNW columnist. Hello. Welcome back into the studio. Neil Payne. Hello.
Rocking a Mets hat.
Neil, I will say, for someone who used to root for the Phillies, the speed with which Neil upgraded his wardrobe upon becoming a Mets fan was really impressive.
Well, you know,
a New Yorker.
Yeah, I moved here. I've embraced it.
Do you just buy sports swag wherever you go?
I've only lived in three cities though.
How much Atlanta swag did you throw away in order to move to Philly?
I was a Braves hater from a very young age. So that can be a topic of another whole podcast.
This is his first swap,
right?
Not his third,
right?
This is his first from Philly to the Mets.
How many lifetime sports swaps do you think you get?
Zero, but I really like Neil.
Kate.
So
fighting words.
I mean, I think that's true. You know, I welcome all haters or critics.
That's what Twitter's for, Neil.
Oh, Twitter is going to eat me the fuck alive.
All right.
Yes. Bleep it out.
Man, Kate, your saltiness got into Neil, too.
Yep.
I'm the only calm one in this booth. On today's show, we're going to talk about sports. I knew it was worth learning how to pronounce Leicester, despite outrageously low odds. Little Leicester City is the champion of the English Premier League. ESPN's Mike Goodman, who has been on, I believe, to talk about Leicester at least twice, if not three times before, will come to finish, you know, his triptych. There's another word for it.
Yes.
And close out.
Is it a real word? Triptych?
Yeah.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Even I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
Triptych.
It's like a trilogy, but different.
Let's alienate everybody.
Listen, we work the high and the low. Joe's in my ear telling me it's triptych. I didn't promise I could pronounce it correctly, just that I could deploy it. Anyway, Mike Goodman's going to be here. We're going to talk about Leicester. Then the NFL draft came and went, and some people can now be paid for their labor. Finally, some of those people are quarterbacks. 15 were selected, leading some to question whether teams were admitting that QB play in the NFL isn't all that great. Neil is going to test that theory using, you know, actual evidence. Neil, is that an accurate summation of what you've done?
That's one interpretation.
Okay, good. And then, has baseball finally figured out how to prevent arm injuries? 538's Rob Arthur will join us to talk about a season of relative health in baseball, at least thus far for pitchers, and whether it's reason to be hopeful that the sport has turned the corner on Tommy John surgeries. And then, of course, a SigDig.
Yeah.
Basketball SigDig, correct, Neil? I
believe so.
Okay, well, I think
that's one interpretation.
I think you're bringing it.
So. I'm bringing it, yes.
All right, let's move on to soccer. Leicester City won the English Premier League yesterday on Monday after Chelsea came back from two goals down to draw 2-2 with Tottenham. Leicester just needed Tottenham not to win in order to clinch it. They clinched it. They didn't even have to play, and they clinched a championship. British soccer is incredible, guys. Leicester became only the sixth team to win the Premier League in the last 24 years, as long as the Premier League has existed. They finished 14th last year. Now they're on top, something like 5,001 odds, which I have a feeling someone should go re-report that and see if it's apocryphal. I feel like it's being mentioned a little too often.
You think that origin story is being twisted?
Yeah, just like it's too cute. It's too neat. But I don't know.
But I mean, we were talking about the 5,001 odds like when we first started talking about this story in the first couple weeks.
I know. And I think even then.
Even then it was apocryphal.
The conspiracy started
early. The triptych
of
it. Yes. I don't know what that means.
Let us bring in now Mike Goodman, that voice chuckling on the other end of the line. Mike Goodman is a writer for ESPN FC. Hello, Mike.
Hey, guys.
All right, Mike.
Yeah, the 5,000-to-1 odds existed, but only some places. I think in Vegas, they said that it was 2,500-to-1 you could have gotten.
That's what I'm talking about. It's sort of cherry-picking.
Basically, the longest odds, and now we just say that those were the odds everywhere.
Right.
I see.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. All right, Mike, you've been on several times before. Let me play you something that you said to us in December. Let's start there.
There's sort of a bunch of teams over the past several years where they're good, they're surprising, they're in the top four around Christmas and New Year's, and it's just such a long slog. Smaller teams tend to have shallower squads, so they don't have enough players to, you know, as many players to ride out injuries and mishaps, plus the fact that you're about to hit the second time through the league, and Leicester have benefited, I think, from having a new manager, from playing slightly differently than expected, and you're not sure if you're going to see that function later in the season.
Mike Goodman, that was you talking, but 6 months ago. What happened? Why were you wrong?
What a dummy. well, actually, I think part of what happened is tactically, teams started playing differently against them, and then they played differently as well. So there was a lot made down the stretch. They won a really ridiculous number of games in a row, exactly 1-0, which was just totally the opposite at the beginning of the season. They went from sort of a team that played up and down, fast-paced attacks, to one that really defended and counterattacked in sort of low-scoring defensive games. And they adjusted very, very well. And then they also, you know, ran on the right side of variance with the ball not ending up in the back of the net, you know, when they were defending. So that's part of it. I mean, but like any story like this, so many things just sort of have to go exactly right to get this result that it's kind of hard to fathom, which is what all the stories have been about.
So do you think, like, the obvious question now is how much of this is kind of replicable going forward or in future years, not just for Leicester, but maybe even for teams that now have aspirations because they've seen what Leicester did, that maybe they could do the same thing? Is that realistic, or is this such a pie in the sky, sort of like once-in-a-lifetime blip on the radar that it can't be repeated?
Yeah, okay. So I think there's two sort of sides to look at for that. The first is the way Leicester ran their team. And I don't think there's a lot of doubt about the fact that Leicester have, for the last couple of years, run their team well. They've made very good personnel decisions. Obviously, hiring Claudio Ranieri was incredibly smart. You know, the stories about acquiring Riyad Mahrez and N'Golo Kante for relatively small sums of money.
Mike, can I interrupt you real quick? I'm just curious, when those decisions were made, were they regarded as good decisions, or is it only now in retrospect? Like, certainly...
That's a good question. There was, you know, they were very close to relegation for most of last season, and I think if you were to ask people through that period of time, you know, were that, you know, were they making good decisions? I don't think anybody would have said, you know, pointed that out particularly. I think with a player like Conte specifically, who they bought last summer, everybody realized right away that he was very, very good. It's a balance, and you know, you want to then go back and say, okay, did they just luck into these guys, or were there processes in place that help you make better decisions. And I think there's sort of enough signal there looking back that you say, well, these guys are approaching things well. They're approaching things smartly. Does that guarantee that you're going to have a miracle season? No, it doesn't. But, you know, you want to take every little edge you can get, and you feel pretty confident saying at this point that they've done a very good job of that.
Hey, Mike, so the three of us at Hot Takedown sat down with Daryl Morey when we were doing the live show at MIT, and we were talking to him about how last year the Houston Rockets, a team that he's the general manager of, had a particularly good year, made it to the Western Conference Finals, and now this year a seemingly similarly constructed team is struggling mightily, gets the eighth seed, but they're his interpretation of why the difference was like, look, all these variables are different. Like, you can't, we got lucky in certain degrees. And I heard you say earlier that for Leicester City, it's like maybe you can't replicate the luck and the certain things that have come into play. Can you lay out for me what about this season has been lucky for them? What are the contextual environmental factors that have allowed this to happen that maybe aren't replicable?
Yeah, sure. So if you look at their underlying numbers, I think there'd probably be a general consensus. They're around the sixth or seventh best underlying numbers. And what we're talking about there is primarily looking at things like expected goals, which is where you look at the set of shots that they've taken and the set of shots that they've given up, and you say, okay, from those shots, you know, given where they happen on the field, what kind of shots they are they headers, are they, you know, with the feet, you know, do they come up fast attacks or slow attacks, all of those kinds of things. You put it all together and you say, okay, these are the amount of goals you'd expect to score, these are the amount of goals you'd expect to concede. And especially over the second half of the year, Leicester has conceded a bunch fewer goals than you would have otherwise expected.
Based on their opponent's shot placements.
Okay, so what do you chalk that up to? Just straight up luck?
I wouldn't. I would chalk it up to things that are not necessarily long-term sustainable, but that doesn't mean that it's luck, right? So if you're better at adjusting than your opponents, you can have these sort of short-term edges. But eventually you're going to get found out and somebody's going to be better at adjusting than you, right? So there are all sorts of factors that I would hesitate to just say, you know, flipping a coin, but that doesn't mean that you say you look at them over the long term and expect them to continue indefinitely.
So I'm curious to follow up on Neil's question about replicability. The money side of this is interesting to me because, and you mentioned that they made some signings that were viewed as good even when they were made, but they were still largely bargain bin signings. Does this suggest that there is a depth in English soccer or in global soccer now that is moving to England, maybe is the better way to put it, that will allow for some more of this type of, for lack of a better word, disruption of the top ranks by teams that otherwise wouldn't have a chance?
Yeah, so there's a couple things going on there. The first is that there's just more money pouring into the Premier League specifically. They're in the final year of what was a record TV deal, and that deal's going to be blown out of the water starting next year. It's the same sort of factors that are happening all over sports with TV rights. So lots of teams in the Premier League have a lot more money than they ever did. Now, that doesn't necessarily even the playing field. I mean, that the sort of the traditional powerhouses still have huge financial advantages. That's what makes this so unlikely. The financial advantages, the likes of which don't exist in U.S. sports, really, with salary caps and revenue sharing. But what it does mean is that a lot of these teams are, you know, the second degree of teams, you know, are not differentiated so much between themselves by revenue, but more on their decision-making. So there was a time when, say, Leicester City could not have competed financially with West Ham. That's gone. And there is now advantages to be gained by who is spending their money better in the transfer market, specifically in sort of the middle class of Premier League soccer team, I think.
But, like, if you make a parallel to, say, college basketball, where mm-hmm. a coach can excel at a place like Wichita State, or if you take Brad Stevens, for example, and on this smaller market, and it's the same with talent, it's almost like a launching pad. And now I have to assume a lot of Leicester City's players who have proven themselves at this level will then be poached to some degree or transferred for millions of dollars. So it seems to me like it will still eventually just end up back, the Premier League, back where you have like the four or five clubs.
That's the traditional model for sure, where even when you had sort of these middle class teams with some modicum of success, fairly quickly their players would be snapped up by the bigger teams. We don't know what it's going to look like now because we don't have a point in time to really reference where one league as a whole, all the teams had significantly more money than the teams in the rest of Europe. And so it used to be if you had a star at, say, West Bromwich Albion or wherever, not only were the top teams in the Premier League going to look to snap up that star, but the top teams in Germany and Italy and PSG and France, you know, Barcelona and Real Madrid and Spain, all of those teams would be in the market for those star players. There are less teams now that can afford to poach a player from Leicester. There's less roster spots. So we don't really know. Leicester is saying they're going to try to keep all these players. They have the money, we think, if they want to.
Right,
they want to pay
now.
Them the big salaries.
Right.
So we're sort of in uncharted territory.
Now, doesn't that also mean that the other teams will kind of have the opportunity, the other EPL teams, that is, to load up themselves and maybe, you know, we always hear about the target being on the back of the defending champion, but that might actually really be the case here with Leicester next year with I can only assume that the top tier teams are going to start spending some of that money you talked about to try to beat them.
Yeah, and again, you know, there's always the argument of, like, the Premier League premium, right, where everybody knows that English teams have money, so everybody is spending more money. You know, everybody's charging them more for players, and does that sort of evaporate some of the edge, right? In theory, it should be a zero-sum game. In practice, there's all sorts of frictional costs, you know, agent fees, you know, that kind of stuff. But, yeah, clearly Manchester United spent over $200 million last summer. They're going to reload again this summer. Chelsea, after winning last year, basically took a summer off, said, "Not, we're good with this team." That blew up spectacularly in their face. They have a new manager. They're going to be back in the market. And then on top of that, Leicester this year benefited from not being in any of the European competitions. They just had fewer games. It's an easier schedule. And they, you know, part of the luck that went into them was they stayed very healthy. They're you know, their top players played an absurd amount of games. So they're going to have to load up on depth, both in anticipation of that not happening and having to deal with a heavier schedule. So it's a much bigger challenge for Leicester next year than it was this year.
Yeah, Mike, just to close, is this the kind of thing that we're going to see again?
Right, so this is the flip side of the Leicester question, right? We spent a lot of time focusing on what did Leicester do, you know, how did, you know, what decisions did they make? But a big part of the story is what the Premier League looked like this year in the absence of not just Leicester, but the traditional powerhouses all to some degree or another blew themselves up. And I think even more than can somebody else do a Leicester, the interesting question that we don't have a good answer to is, was this just a confluence of circumstances, you know, among the big powerhouses, or is there something fundamentally different going forward about the Premier League? We don't really have a good answer to that yet.
Mike Goodman, that completes your work of art. Your three-piece work of art.
You're like a piece of Renaissance work.
Yeah, that triptych was just, it really, those final, those God, final that strokes.
Word,
those
that,
final
strokes. That word is just so wrong.
What, because it sounds slightly vulgar?
Yeah.
Triptych.
Oh, is that how you're saying it? It sounded a little different
before. Should I say it? Yeah. All right, Mike Goodman, we'll have you on soon. Thanks for coming through.
All right, great. Thanks, guys.
And before we keep going with the show, here is a word from our sponsor. This week, Hot Takedown is supported by SeatGeek, the only place to look for tickets to a game or concert online. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated. They try to sneak in extra fees. You don't really know what you're getting until checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. You can even set alerts for upcoming games, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Here's the important thing, Hot Takedown listeners. You can get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter that promo code, our promo code, takedown, as in Hot Takedown, and then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code TAKEDOWN today. 15 quarterbacks were taken in the NFL draft this year, one for nearly every other team in the league. That kind of stat is catnip for folks like ESPN's Ron Jaworski, who analyzed why that many QBs were drafted.
There's really a couple of reasons. Number one, in the National Football League, what gives you your best chance to win on a consistent basis? By having a rock-solid quarterback that can give you 60 minutes of play over 16 games, that gives you your best percentage chance. And right now, there's a dearth of starting quarterbacks in the NFL. There's a lot of quarterbacks, but I would say about 50% of them give you consistent play week in and week out. So you're going to see players pushed up like we saw the last few days. 15 quarterbacks being drafted.
Neil, I saw the brows furrow. I saw the head much give like, a slight shake.
Much like when you said the word triptych. I can't even pronounce it. I don't know what it is.
Okay. Tell me why Ron Jaworski might be wrong, Neil.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so he said that there's just so much to unpack in that.
So there are two main
claims, I think. Yeah, go
ahead. That 15 is like an astronomical number.
Right. So three main claims. That's a good one, too. 15 astronomical number. To me, also, that a good quarterback gives you the best percentage chance of winning in the NFL.
Three, that quarterback play is worse than it's ever been.
And that 50% give you, quote, consistent play.
Right.
So,
right.
So let's break down.
Neil,
let's break down.
Break it all down for us.
Thing by thing.
Yeah.
So first, is 15 a number that is aberrationally high?
So he said like 50%. That's something that I was kind of like hung up on when he talked about 50% of the quarterbacks can give you.
You want to
go there first?
I wanted to go there first.
I mean, because we asked you a specific question, because pivoted.
I have the numbers in front of me.
I wanted to go to the 50%.
Okay. All right, do that one first.
Yeah, then we'll work backwards.
Because that was fresh on my mind, and just because it's like, well, you would expect half of quarterbacks to, first of all, this idea of consistency, it makes me think of Joe Morgan. You know, there was a great baseball blog called Fire Joe Morgan, where they, you know, Joe Morgan was the baseball commentator for ESPN Sunday Night Games for a number of years. And he would always be fixated on this idea of consistency. That he used consistency as sort of an analog for being good, but being consistent isn't. You could be consistently bad. That would be a bad thing. If you were a terrible quarterback, you would want inconsistency, because then sometimes you might play better, you know, and luck into it that way. But so even if he's saying like 50% of starting quarterbacks are above average, like that is exactly what you would expect. That's not weird. And, you know, I don't know about 15 quarterbacks being taken. I don't know if that's...
Let me tell you about those.
But yeah, please tell me if that's aberrational or not.
2004, 17 quarterbacks were taken. 2010, 14 quarterbacks were taken. 2014, just 2 years ago, 14 quarterbacks were taken. I'm not sure that has anything to do with the quality in the league, especially because the quarterbacks that were taken, they're not all taken to be starting quarterbacks. You know, if you draft a quarterback in the seventh round, then you drafted a quarterback in the seventh round, and maybe you're thinking of him as a future trade piece, or you're thinking of him as filling a third in depth chart quarterback spot.
Sure, there's like 90 quarterback slots that need to be filled on rosters.
Put somebody in there.
Somebody's got to be in there, and yeah, I would imagine most of these guys, I don't have the number in front of me, but probably most of them were taken relatively low. I think we had a story that ran last week that looked at, you know, a lot of quarterbacks are taken in the first round, disproportionately so relative to other positions, and then there's sort of this like trough in which they're not really taken in the mid rounds, and then they're taken a lot late in the draft. And, you know, I don't know what the relative proportions of those two types are, but I would imagine at least half of these guys each year that you rattled off are just sort of like roster filler types or whatever.
Catnip.
So no one is expecting them to.
That's what we gave Ron Jaworski's.
Well, that's what he gave us. That's what quarterbacks gave him.
I'm just bringing it full circle.
Yeah. Yeah, and then to finish your triptych of questions, Chad, what was the
one? So the idea behind the fact that 15 quarterbacks were taken is this idea that, as Ron Jaworski says, that quarterback play in a way is worse than it's ever been. That's kind of what I was inferring what he was saying, and so then because I've heard that said, is that quarterback play in the NFL is declining. And then a lot of people will posit that the reason it's declining is because on the younger levels, on college down to high school, so many teams and programs are running like a spread offense or a West Coast offense, and there doesn't have to be this strict adherence to a playbook. And then you get to the NFL, and a lot of these quarterbacks have learned football in one specific way, and then they're not prepared for the playbook level at the NFL. It's kind of a similar comparison to how we always say, well, if play in the NBA is declining, it's because of AAU. And to me, it's like, okay, so you've got this idea that the play is declining, then you're working backward to explain it. And then if you actually even look at it, I'm not sure that the quarterback play is declining. Neil, do you have any numbers for if it actually is as bad and as we seem to be saying it is?
Yeah, well, one thing I looked at was just about, you know, sort of production by what tier a quarterback was within the league. So you would expect if there's sort of this dearth of good quarterbacks that, for instance, like the 70th percentile quarterback in terms of, you know, yards above replacement, which is a Football Outsider stat, given that tier within the league, that the production of that person would kind of drop over time. So if there are fewer good quarterbacks, then like the 60th, 70th percentile quarterback now would be worse than he was in the past. But that's not really true. If you break it down looking at any number of kind of tiers within the league, 90th, 80th, 70th, 60th, even 50th percentile, they're all relatively flat over time. Like your 80th percentile quarterback now is roughly as good as your 80th percentile quarterback was in the 70s. If you adjust for, you know, the passing overall, you know, environment of the league. So it just doesn't make any sense, I don't think. And we may be in a time in which, at least before Peyton Manning retired, of, you know, as many active Super Bowl winning quarterbacks as ever. You know, you had Eli Manning, you had, in addition to Brady and Peyton
Manning,
you had
Drew Brees,
you had Russell Wilson, you had Ben Roethlisberger. Well, but I'm saying that those quarterbacks, well, that's kind of circular, right? Like, you can look at the stats, mm-hmm. and you can kind of do what I did and see that it's pretty flat. And then people say, oh, well, Andy Dalton was the, you know, 80th percentile quarterback in football. And so clearly the stats don't mean anything. So then if you make it about the rings, then you can see that there are a lot of active quarterbacks who have won Super Bowls. And then, you can do what you just did, Chad, and flip it around and also say that it's because of parity. But to a certain extent, this is an unanswerable question because the NFL is a closed system. And you can't drop Johnny Unitas into the 2016 NFL and figure out whether, you know, how that lined up relative across eras. But I don't know. It just seems like kind of a baseless claim that gets thrown around a ton.
Right. And we're looking at this graph that I'm assuming will be up on 538 about QBs aren't getting worse at each tier. And if I'm hoping you have the answer to this question, people can see it if they're looking at the graph. It looks like in 2009, there's like a huge spike. Do you have any reason to explain for in 2009 why like 80th percentile quarterbacks were like performing so well?
I don't know what year that is because I think it might be I am not pinpointing it exactly, but when I saw that spike, the first thing that jumped to my mind was 2011 and the season in which you had the all-time, I want to say yardage record be set, or touchdown record be set or something like that. But then you also had like five quarterbacks throw for more than 4,000 yards or 4,500 yards. I'm totally blanking on the numbers right now, but it was an epic season, even after adjusting mm-hmm. for the overall passing environment. So maybe that's what that spike is.
Because it's really the only spike in like what looks like the last 20 years that is any distinct from mm-hmm. the quarterback play across all percentiles and levels.
Right.
So I want to get to one other thing that Jaworski said in his hot take, which is that still, your best percentage chance to win in the NFL is to have a good quarterback. And we've been around this argument several times. I think we've talked about how we've asked whether or not in football, whether one star can be as important as let's say in basketball, and that star presumably is the quarterback.
Right.
But and it had me thinking about the Super Bowl last year, which we saw a team with, at best, a mediocre quarterback in his current form, won the Super Bowl with a great defense that overcame someone who was, you know, thought to be a quarterback in the top 20 percentile of the league.
And you're also like, well, if the quarterback market is kind of on a bubble now, which it kind of seemed to be for a little while, considering what people paid for Brock Osweiler, well, then what is there a contrarian play in there? Mm-hmm. Is Denver
to bulk
making
up your defense? You're saying in
yeah,
order
to
take
be
down
like,
these
look, we're not going to overpay a mediocre quarterback, so we're going to play a little bit differently. And I mean, Denver, it's not necessarily a contrarian play, but they certainly haven't gone out there and just overspent and panicked to try and get a QB. And somehow I'm going to tie this to Lester, where it's like, okay, well, maybe we can't compete and pay huge money, but we're going to then have a different style. So I'm wondering if in the NFL, if there is a QB bubble, and you can say maybe there isn't, that is there an opportunity to make a contrarian play there?
Well, I think that's probably true to some extent because the amount of money that you know, since there's a salary cap, if you spend money on a quarterback, you can't spend money on defense and other areas of the game. So then, you know, if you flip that around and you cheap out on a quarterback and realize that, you know, maybe that 60th percentile quarterback can get you there if you take the extra money and spend it on you know, defense and receivers, maybe that's the answer. But I've never seen a systematic study either way, which is sad. We should do one.
But we all kind of accept that, like, you better have a quality quarterback, and that's the absolute foundation, generally speaking, to have a Super Bowl winning team. And we have these outliers of, like, the Denver Broncos and then Trent Dilfer and the Baltimore Ravens in, like, 2001. But, like, do you believe that?
No, I mean, we've also seen, like, Joe Flacco, who played great during the Ravens' Super Bowl run, but aside from that has been a pretty average quarterback overall, go on a Super Bowl run. So I think, you know, and Eli Manning has been up and down to wild degrees throughout his career. So when you see guys like that capable of winning Super Bowls, it does kind of punch a hole in the argument, and together with the fact that Peyton Manning, who had a horrendous season last year, won the Super Bowl. I wonder if the idea now over the past decade or so that you must have an elite starting quarterback, which is of course the absurd kind of cliched phrase that they always threw around when talking about this kind of thing, that you must have one of those guys to win a Super Bowl, might be dead or might be dying recently.
I encourage everyone to Google Donald Trump, is Joe Flacco an elite quarterback, in which Donald Trump answers this question of whether Joe Flacco is an elite quarterback.
It's a fundamentally existential question that
retrofitted to make Joe Flacco and Eli Manning elite because we can't untether elite from Super Bowl winning.
And we can't make sense of, maybe this is what you're trying to say, or this is what you have said, which is we can't make sense of a team that has won a Super Bowl with a non-elite quarterback.
Right, because we've had this myth for so long. But if you actually go back to 2008 and then you got two Eli Mannings, Joe Flacco, the Denver Broncos having subpar QB play, even though he was once an elite quarterback. Like, there's actually a lot.
Tim Tebow's going to be winning the Super Bowl before long. So one other thing.
I don't know about that, Chad. But
one other thing is that our colleague Ben Morris at Fire 38 often talks about NFL teams as far as where they're spending their resources, because it is a salary cap league. And so, you know, teams spend a lot of money on quarterbacks, but what if they distributed that money to have above average players at almost every other position? You had just an average quarterback and tried to make cost savings.
Walt Hickey can win the Super Bowl.
That's true.
Well, we've found
it
happen.
We've seen it happen.
And our loyal listeners will know what I'm talking about.
And only our loyal.
And only, like, there's eight of them out there who are nodding along to that.
All right. So what we've proven today is that Ron Jaworski maybe should come on the show, and we'll gently try and inform him for future SportsCenter appearances.
Well, I'd just love to talk to him in general, you know.
Jaws. You're out there.
Come on the show.
All right. Oh, shall we move on from football
to
baseball? Let's do it. After Mets prospect succumbed to Tommy John surgery, I have stopped living in fear of it. Now I just accept that it is an inevitability. Or is it? Tommy John surgeries are mysteriously down this year, and nobody is quite sure why. 538's Rob Arthur has been doing some reporting on this and joins us now. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Rob,
I heard it's your first appearance.
Yeah.
How does it feel? Do you feel invigorated?
I feel honored.
Cool.
Wow.
We're honored.
Good answer.
I finally did something worthwhile.
Yeah. You've been anointed. All right. So, Rob, before we get to the data trends, can you just break down the Tommy John surgery for us? Not in the gory details, but just, you know, what kind of injuries these are and sort of the history of it, because I know you've written about that as well.
Yeah, sure. The Tommy John surgery is to repair the ligament in the elbow that frequently gets hurt, especially in pitchers. And prior to the surgery's invention, that when the ligament went, it was pretty much the end of a pitcher's career. Once the surgery came around, though, pitchers started coming back from this and often having quite lengthy, productive careers after this surgery. So it was a real, really important landmark for pitching and for sports injuries. Since the last about 5 years, the surgery prevalence of the surgery has been increasing almost on a sort of exponential curve, and that has prompted a lot of concern that you know, eventually we're just going to run out of pitchers. Everyone's going to have Tommy John, and they'll have it, you know, not just once in their career, but two, maybe three times, and there won't be any pitchers left to throw Major League Baseball games.
And you've written, though, that pitchers are able to come back from these injuries better than, for example, the shoulder injuries that was the epidemic before elbow injuries were.
Yeah, it's interesting that this concern over the epidemic has been so significant, because actually the increase in the Tommy John surgeries corresponds with a decrease in the number of shoulder surgeries. And shoulder surgeries are actually much more devastating to a pitcher's career.
They come back with less velocity and things like that.
Right. That is pretty much career ending in a lot of cases. Tommy John surgeries, like I said, although there are occasionally pitchers that don't make it back, they tend to be relievers and guys that were on the fringe of being in baseball to begin with. Oftentimes, a starter, for example, is able to come back from a Tommy John surgery and be close to as good as they were before. So it's not a career ender like shoulder surgeries were.
Okay, and so just before we get to the full analysis, what is the trend this year that within Tommy John surgeries?
So remarkably, the number of Tommy John surgeries has declined by about twofold. So there were 20 surgeries this year through April, and there were 40 2 years ago. So there are many, many fewer Tommy John surgeries. And so that's really good. We're losing many fewer pitchers than we were recently in the heart of the Tommy John epidemic.
Now, Rob, is there reason to think that this is because we've kind of discovered something medically or something in the way pitchers are treated that makes it less likely to happen even, you know, versus a few years ago? Or is it possible that the crisis was kind of overblown in the first place a few years ago?
So I think based on the people that we've spoken with, it seems likely that it's partially that there was bad luck in the last 2 years in terms of how many people were affected by Tommy John surgery. So I said before that 2 years ago there were 40 surgeries through April, which is really incredible. And it was especially incredible because the year before that, I think there were only about 18 or 17. So it really spiked very high, and maybe that indicates some bad luck. And the fact that it's now coming back down to 20 surgeries, you know, maybe there's a combination of bad luck before and good luck now. And so this decline in surgeries is suggesting, like you said, that the Tommy John epidemic was never quite as bad as we thought it was, even though it's still affecting quite a few pitchers.
Rob, I know because I'm a Mets fan that there was the issue with Matt Harvey about pitch count and how if you want to limit a potential future injury, there's like certain inning and pitch counts and all of that. And now we are occasionally using words like coddling a pitcher because we have these limits. I'm wondering, in your opinion, do you think like years from now it will seem crazy how much we let pitchers pitch? Is the amount of stress that they're actually putting on their arms actually pretty dramatic?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that as this push towards limiting pitch counts has happened in the majors, it's also been happening in the minors. So, you know, we're seeing pitchers throw many fewer pitches at the major league level, but then they're also getting prepared for this earlier in their careers when they're training. A great example of this is Julio Urias, who's the Dodgers' top prospect, and he's never thrown an outing longer than six innings in his minor league career. So there's a question, you know, maybe when he gets to the majors and he's expected to throw complete games, maybe he won't be prepared for that. On the other hand, by the time he gets to the majors, maybe pitchers really won't be throwing very many complete games anymore. Maybe it'll only be six inning starts and then I'll hand it over to shut down relief corps. So I don't know if pitchers were throwing too many innings before or too many pitches before, but it does seem like, overall baseball is evolving towards shorter starts and fewer pitches and just more intense outings over shorter time spans.
And that's what's really interesting to me, Rob, is that I think there's an acknowledgement within baseball that pitching is by its nature sort of an unnatural activity, and it's one that's going to put a lot of stress on the arm. And Dr. Glenn Feisig, I believe his name, is sort of the go-to source on Tommy John, and says that the UCL, the tendon, can break at any pitch, basically, that there's so much stress being put on the arm that it's sort of liable to break at any moment. And what's interesting to me is that we're reducing pitch count as an acknowledgement that that's the case, maybe, that, that every pitch is wear and tear. But as you said, that intensity is going up. And so are we, like, trending towards where starters are going to be five-inning pitchers or something, you know, the mediocre starters are, and it's going to be super intense, almost like a bullpen pitcher, where they're going to throw harder during those five innings and not try and conserve energy. And then it'll be a game that's sort of more chopped up than it used to be?
Yeah, I think that is the overall trend. I mean, one thing that we do know causes more stress, and for pretty obvious reasons, is the harder a pitcher throws, the more stress is going on in their arm, and the more likely they are to be injured. So these shorter outings allow pitchers to throw harder than they ever have before, and we know that the number of pitches that are above 95 miles per hour, above 97 miles per hour, it has been really exploding recently in MLB. At the same time, though, you can't keep throwing that velocity for very long. So I agree with you. It seems like the game is evolving towards this point where it's going to be more pitchers throwing harder and throwing more intensely, but for shorter stints.
Well, it seems like that makes the most sense, like to move toward a space where, as a fan, you're seeing pitchers at every moment of the game throwing their absolute hardest. But then you are also losing, like, the story of a certain pitcher who is weaving this magical night, right? Like we saw.
But what if those stories were leading to those pitchers having fewer magical nights in the future? I mean, that's
right, exactly.
What we're seeing.
But then you're kind of like, I don't know if it's just a story we've told ourselves historically as we watch baseball, that the opportunity to see a pitcher pitch a complete game, and whether it's going to be a no-hitter mm-hmm. or a shutout, is what we should be hoping for and expecting. And are we going to be able to then tell ourselves, mm-hmm. like, showing up to see Matt Harvey pitch five innings is as
the
good
new
as
new normal.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it woven into the fabric of baseball, the fact that we have wins assigned to the starting pitcher
and
various other things?
And that you need to pitch for five innings if you're a
to
starter
get
to
win.
Get the win. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Kate that I like to see a good workhorse starter go out and throw a complete game. And
said
I think
like
that's
a true
Bartolo Colon.
No, said like a Jake Arrieta worshiper.
Yes, yes, I do like Jake Arrieta, and he's a great example of that. But at the same time, we are seeing the rise of the super reliever, right? And those guys are pretty exciting, too. I mean, it's cool to see Aroldis Chapman, for example, come out and throw 103-mile-per-hour pitches. It's not quite as maybe romantic to see him replacing a gassed starter, but it is cool to see what these one-inning guys can do for a short period of time and how incredible they are at throwing the ball at this point.
The other interesting thing for me, Rob, about the idea of even limiting guys in the minors is there some validity to this idea that an arm has just like a certain number of throws, especially at these high velocities in it, you know, kind of almost like inherently inside of it. And once you reach that limit, and no one knows what that limit actually is, but it sounds like they're treating the arm like it's a ticking time bomb that could really, you know, be destroyed and incapable of throwing at a major league level at any given time. So almost like the more of those pitches that you can shift from instead of the minors to be at the major league level before a guy, you know, just totally burns himself out, then that's kind of what the smart teams seem to be kind of shifting things toward, which sounds really macabre, but I don't know. Is that the sense that you get, Rob?
Yeah, it is. And we can see some evidence for that in the data, actually, in the sense that where you're really seeing the sharpest drop-off in pitches in the minors are for the top prospects. The guys that were listed in the Baseball America Top 100, they've seen their pitch counts decline more than the overall average. So it does seem like once a team knows it has a top guy, a guy that's going to be a productive major league starter, they're trying to limit their workload as much as possible in the minors and get them up to the majors as soon as possible so that they can start expending some of those few pitches they have in their arm, actually getting major league hitters out and contributing to the major league team's success.
All right, Rob, readers can read your analysis of the decline in Tommy John injuries later this week on 538. Thanks for coming through.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, now it is time for our significant digit when someone brings us a telling number from the world of sports this week.
That someone is me.
The Sig Dig offer is Neil Payne.
Offer it up.
I'm going to offer up the number 33.5. That is the difference between the offensive efficiency that the Thunder defense allowed to the Spurs in Game 1 of their series and in Game 2. So in Game 1, the there's no other way to say it. The Spurs torched the Thunder defense. They put up 134 points per 100 possessions, which is how we measure offensive efficiency. And that was Oklahoma City's worst defensive game of the season and San Antonio's second best offensive game of the season. So they kind of saved their worst defensive effort for one of the most important games. But in game two, they only allowed a 100.5 offensive efficiency to the Spurs, and that was tied for San Antonio's 15th worst offensive game of the entire season. So vast improvement between game two and game
one. Neil, I want your take on something, because I think on Around the Horn we had this discussion about whether like specific adjustments account for different output or if it's just an increase in effort. I want to know what was your take, because
like
and the topic,
adjustments,
right, the topic was Brad Stevens for the Celtics at one point at the end of their series put Marcus Smart on Millsap at the end of that Millsap's huge game, and there was this brilliant adjustment that accounted for a change in defensive tone. But I'm usually like, to me, watching the Thunder game, the game two, almost all of that difference in defensive efficiency number was the result of just like way more effort.
Yeah, I think
rather than like a specific adjustment, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably true in this case for sure. Like watching that first game and just like the Thunder, they seemed in total disarray throughout it. And so when they started playing in game two, especially like a real NBA defense, it seemed right. Like they, you know, they were bound to play better. And I think also like it's kind of weird because it's a game of adjustments and counter adjustments. And it's kind of this game theory where you're trying to, you know, when a team is doing something well, then by nature, especially when you're in the playoffs against another really good team, they will take that away. And then you have to find kind of another avenue in. And basketball is a sport that seems to show this a lot, where the higher that you kind of go, or the further from the norm that you go, the quicker and the more rapid you will be kind of pulled back toward your normal self or toward the mean. And another part of that, I think, is also just like luck. Some of the things that SportVU tracking cameras can do now is they can actually quantify how, in a sense, how lucky you are. Some of it is like shot making skill, but they can assign to any given point in the floor based on the location and the proximity of the closest defender and, you know, the type of shot, was it a catch and shoot, etc., what the odds of any given player in the league making that shot would be. And so if you're living above that, your means, in a certain way, and kind of making more of those shots than you ought to based on the types of shots that you're getting consistently, some of that is absolutely skill, but some of that is luck, and it does tend to reverse. And so I think now with all the data that coaches have, and just, you know, it kind of confirms old school intuition too, that, you know, the old like adage that it's a make or miss league, and the old idea of like the coach with the no, yes, you know, shot selection, that eventually those things kind of turn around. And I think San Antonio in game one was hot shooting to the absolute maximum degree, and that was something that kind of, you know, was less the case in game two.
That hat looks really good on you.
Thank you.
It does, doesn't
That's
it?
Our clothes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's
the
a,
blue
he's a
and
natural
orange.
Mets fan.
Looks good.
You can hear more compliments of Neil's Mets hat on Panic City.
I knew.
My spinoff.
Well, Kate, when
professional
are you
radioing by you right there.
Yeah.
Yes. When are you going to be on Panic City? That's my
If
question.
You want me to come on and give very broad opinions about the Mets, like, hey, we went to the World Series last year and we won 8 games in a row, I'm there for you.
Excellent. Hey, all right. that's cool. All we
After
need.
After you hand the book.
Don't remind me.
Should I not?
There's a lot of book writing
am I
to be.
Not supposed to say it?
It's a sore spot of anxiety.
Okay. Sorry.
Oh, boy.
All right. That on that anxious note, then we'll close this week's show. Kate Fagan, may you work through your anxiety in the coming week.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks for coming on. Neil Payne, that hat looks good on you.
It does.
Thanks, Chad. Wow, I'm just soaking up these compliments.
Yes.
And I just want to say that I'm really happy that you're in studio, Kate.
It's fun to be in studio.
Yeah,
so I can dish out these compliments.
Yeah, it's great that we're all here.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast triptych is Jody Avergan, Tony Chow, and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. Guys, you realize we are the triptych, right? That is the point.
Oh,
we should rename
my
this
God.
Podcast.
Mind blown.
To the erstwhile triptychs. The erstwhile triptychs.
Yeah, we're on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. While you're there, review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. We've got other podcasts at 538. We've got an elections podcast. We're doing a live show tomorrow.
Very excited.
Been there, done that. Called Will and Kate.
Will and Kate have Will a podcast. Kate,
go get that podcast. It's near Panic City, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Wow. In the charts. Oh, yeah.
Somewhere near. It's like very, I'm making a gesture of low.
For us, for Panic City.
Probably
yeah,
for us, too.
Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.